Series of studies on the prophecy of Hosea. Now, I'd like to follow somewhat the format that we used for the introduction of the prophecy of Joel. In other words, we begin with the man himself and then move on through his times, his audience, and his style. The man is, of course, Hosea, and his name is Hosea. Aside from Hosea's name, we know practically nothing of the man himself. So if you will, just turn to the book of Hosea for a moment and notice the first verse of this particular prophecy. Hosea, the first book in the Minor Prophets. Hosea. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, and so on. Hosea, right after the book of Daniel. Hosea, chapter 1 and verse 1. And you'll notice the first words of this first verse are these. The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea, the son of Beeri. Now, that's all we know of Hosea. We don't know anything more than the fact that he was the son of Beeri, and whatever is said about Hosea in this book and his tragic marriage. But this is about all we know of the man Hosea. Now, the name Hosea means salvation, or more probably it means Jehovah saves. But it's basically the same, salvation or Jehovah saves. It's the same basic name as Joshua and Jesus. As you all know, Joshua and Jesus are exactly the same name. Joshua is the name Jesus in the Old Testament in Hebrew, and Jesus is the name Joshua in Greek. It's the same name, Jesus and Joshua. And Jesus and Joshua means Jehovah saves. So we have again, or Jehovah is salvation. So we have the same basic name, Hosea, Joshua, Jesus, or Hosea, which is the same as Hosea, actually. Hosea and Hosea are the same names. But they all have the idea of salvation, or Jehovah saves. But that's all we know of Hosea. Now there's a lesson in that. Hosea isn't going around tooting his horn as far as his own credentials are concerned. You don't learn a lot about Hosea except for what you see in this book about his prophecy. There's nothing said of him in the historical book. And the lesson is really this, that God uses people, it's true, but when he uses people, it's not necessary for the person to show off who or what he is. God uses simple folk. God uses simple language. God uses just ordinary people, and he can use any single one of us. We may not be prestigious or great in the eyes of the world, but God can use it. God used Hosea. There's not a word of Hosea in any of the historical books. As far as we know, he was one of the minor prophets. He's not even mentioned in any of the historical books. But yet, God used him to write this 14-chapter book. And all we know of him is his name, salvation, or Jehovah's faith. The next thing we notice about him is his time. His time. Now here, I would like to go back and review just a point or two. You may remember that we, at the very introduction to the whole studies on the minor prophets, looked at three periods of the prophets. Three basic times when they prophesied. One is known as the Assyrian period, the 8th to the 7th centuries B.C. Another period of time that the prophets were working is in the 7th century B.C., the Babylonian period. And the third is the Persian period, the 6th to the 5th century B.C. Now, can anybody remember another name for this period? Huh? Can you remember that? All right, this is the exilic period. Remember, the Jews were in the country of Judah was carried away into captivity in the 7th century. The nation of Israel, I should say, and Judah was carried away captive, and they were carried away by the Babylonians. The southern kingdom was carried away captive by the Babylonians. Now, what would this one be called? Pre-exilic, brilliant. And this one? Genius, post-exilic. So we have pre-exilic, exilic, and post-exilic. There are three basic periods. Now, the prophets that we are looking at so far are in this period, the Assyrian period. Joel prophesied in the pre-exilic period, before the nation of Judah was carried away to exile by the Babylonians. we see tonight Hosea is prophesying in the pre-exilic period before the northern kingdom is carried away into captivity. So there are three periods, the Assyrian, the Babylonian, and the Persian, or the 8th to the 7th century, the 7th century, and the 6th to the 5th century. And we tonight are involved in this first one, the Assyrian period. If I talk long enough, we'll be able to get all these notes down. Everybody will have it down. I think most of us have it. If you don't, we can get it later. All right, now let's move on just a wee bit more to look at the situation that was involved in the ministry of Hosea. Look at your Bibles now, and look at Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea the son of Beeri in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now that is a most important statement, for that gives us the historical setting and gives us the background in which Hosea prophesied. Let's begin with the kings of Judah on the right. You'll notice that they're listed over here, for these are the four kings that are listed in verse 1. You'll notice it. The days of Uzziah, there's Uzziah, Jotham, there's Jotham, Ahaz, and there's Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. You'll notice their dates. Now, these dates are only approximate. You'll notice that in any Bible dictionary or something like the Bible dictionary, a Bible handbook, you'll have these dates, but they'll be approximately the same as this. They may vary a couple of years because it cannot be that precise. But you'll notice that Uzziah reigned from 767 B.C. to 739. That was a long reign. Then Jotham from 739 B.C. to 735. Ahaz from 735 B.C. to 715 B.C. and Hezekiah from 715 B.C. to 686 B.C. Now, you'll notice that the prophecy of Hosea is in the span of all four of these kings. That's a long period of time. You'll notice also that the only king that is mentioned is Jeroboam, and this is Jeroboam II, who reigned from 781 B.C. to 753 B.C. In a word, I'll explain why he mentioned just one of these. He does not go through all of them. But I want you to see, first of all, the wide period of time involved in Hosea's prophecy. He prophesied from before 753 B.C. to sometime after 715 B.C. In other words, he had to prophesy sometime during the reign of Jeroboam before 753 B.C. because it overlapped Uzziah, but sometime from before 753 B.C. down to sometime after 715 B.C., meaning Hosea prophesied for, well, here we have 40 years alone, and there is time before and time after, so we can say that Hosea prophesied for a good 50 years. Some feel that he was an old man before he died, and he prophesied as long as 65 years, but he had a very long reign. That's the small thing to notice. There is more to notice than that. We are looking not just at the duration, but we want to look at the condition that obtained during Hosea's prophecy. And we can tell Chad right here. Notice these kings, all these kings, and notice the brevity of their reign. 753, 752, 752 to 741, 741 to 739, 739 to 731, 731 to 722. Some of these are very, very brief. One of these is only 1 month long. Now, what I'm trying to get across is this, and there's more. We'll have more yet. What I'm trying to get across is this. You'll notice that Jeroboam is the only one that's listed by Hosea. And you may say, why is Jeroboam the only one to the king of Israel that is listed when all four kings of Judah are listed? Well, I think there are a couple of answers to that. I'll come back to that in a moment. Here is the land of Palestine. Now, you remember that over this land of Palestine, there were three kings that ruled over the whole land. The first one was, who was the first king of Israel? All right, Saul. The next one? David and David's son. All right, these are the only three kings that ruled over the whole land. Then there was a great rebellion, and the northern kingdom withdrew from the southern kingdom. Let me get my overlays lined up here. So that they have two kingdoms, Judah to the south and Israel to the north. The kings of Judah that we saw, the four kings, were all descendants of David. There was just one family that ruled out of Jerusalem here in Judah. This was all of the line of David. Up here, there is one family after another. In fact, in the nation of Israel to the north, there were no less than nine different families. They slaughtered each other. And when one family would take over from another, he wouldn't just kill the king. He'd kill all the sons and all the brothers. He'd kill all the families so that there'd be nothing left of the family to claim the throne, and then he would set up his throne. Now, the kings that we are looking at are the kings to the north, the kings in this nation, Israel. This is the nation that was carried away captive by the Assyrians. This nation later on, Judah, was carried away by the Babylonians. But what we are involved in are the conditions in Israel, in this northern kingdom, with their various kings. Now let's go back to these kings for just a moment and look at them. Jeroboam is the only one that's listed. I think the reason for that is given in 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 30. So let's go back to 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 30. 2 Kings chapter 10 and verse 30. Second Kings chapter 10 verse 30. And the Lord said unto Jehu, this is 2 Kings chapter 10 verse 30. And the Lord said unto Jehu, because thou hast done well in executing that which is right in mine eyes, and hath done unto the house of Ahab according to all that was in thine heart, thy children of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. Now, when you look at the genealogy, you'll notice that Jeroboam's forefather was Jehu. And then he had a son and a son, and the fourth generation would be Jeroboam. Jehu would be the first, then a son, and a grandson, and a great-grandson, Jeroboam. And Jeroboam was the last king that was promised and ordained of God to rule over Israel. All of the others just took the throne because they wanted to. Before this time, God would use a prophet to set apart a man like Jehu and say, Jehu, you are going to be the one who's going to kill Jehoram and all of his family, and you will become the king and set up the kingdom in the northern kingdom. Jehu was chosen by God. Jeroboam was the fourth generation, and after that, all of these just took the throne because they wanted to. But there's more. Jeroboam was a great king. He wasn't a good king. He was a great king, not a good king. He was a powerful king. He extended the borders of the northern kingdom farther than any other king. In other words, Jeroboam brought prosperity and power to the northern kingdom. And the northern kingdom was reveling in this power. And Hosea begins his ministry while the northern kingdom is in prosperity. But then it begins to become degraded, and everything begins to fall apart, and anarchy sets in. Let me illustrate by pointing out how these kings took over one from another so quickly. This man, Zechariah, reigned 6 months, and he was killed by Shalom. And Shalom was a whole new family. Shalom reigned 1 month in 752. He reigned 1 month, and he was killed by Menahem. Menahem's son, Pekahiah, reigned. And this is the only one where you have a son taking over. Otherwise, the son doesn't even get a chance to reign. Somebody comes along and kills him. Pekahiah was killed by Pekah. And Pekah was killed by Hosea. And Hosea was the one that was carried away in captivity to Assyria. So he just began to get the sense of just murder, murder. This one was murdered by Shalom. Shalom was murdered by Menahem. Pekahiah was murdered by Pekah. Pekah was murdered by Hoshea. Hoshea is carried away captive to Israel. It's just bloodshed and anarchy, and everything is just disorganized, and it shows the corruption that had set into the northern kingdom. And Hosea is prophesying through this whole period of time, and he witnesses the power, the glory of the northern kingdom, and then its degradation. So we can look at the time of Hosea, first of all, nationally. Then we can move on to the times of Israel or Hosea internationally. We are just looking at the situation in which Hosea lived. And first of all, we could say his time nationally. We could summarize it by one word: anarchy. 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 The second part we can look at is the international situation in which he lived. Internationally, there were two world powers. And this is going to become important in the book, because this is part of the background of the book. To the north, there was Assyria. To the south and the southwest, there was Egypt. These were the two great powers. Now, there were people in Israel who said, let's make alliances with Egypt. We need more power. Let's make alliances with Egypt. Others were saying, no, let's make alliances with Assyria. And so they were fluttering back and forth. And Hosea says, you're like a fluttering bird. And there's nothing like a fluttering bird for not knowing where it's going to go. And so it says, this is the way you are. You're like a fluttering bird. You want to make alliances with Assyria one time, and then another time you want to make alliances with Egypt. And they were just going back and forth. They weren't really trusting in the Lord. The times nationally, anarchy. The times internationally, they were fluctuating between Assyria and Egypt. Now the times spiritually. When the northern kingdom established itself as a kingdom, the northern kingdom was afraid, the kings of the northern kingdom were afraid that the people of Israel would go down to Judah and worship at Jerusalem. So they set up their own worship in the northern kingdom. They set up their own creed, and it was corrupt. They designed this, had all kinds of idol worship. They had oxen and calves that they made into images and worshiped them. But the worst was Baal worship. So you actually had three things. You had Baal. You had idolatry in the form of oxes and calves. And by the way, when you had these oxen and calves, by and large, the people felt they were worshiping Jehovah. They just made Jehovah in the form of oxen and calves. And they felt they were worshiping God in these forms. So you had Baal, idolatry. Baal is the god of the Philistines, by the way. Idolatry, and then besides this, a false priesthood. Now, all this was doomed to lead to corruption. Whenever you have a false religion, whenever you have idolatry, whenever you have false gods, you're going to have immorality. And when you get into the book of Hosea, you're going to find it's adultery, adultery and immorality. You're going to find that there's murder and bloodshed. You're going to find that the poor are oppressed and the rich are oppressing the poor. You're going to find all these things just because of the false religion. And false religion abounded in the northern kingdom. And here is poor Hosea ministering in the southern kingdom with anarchy, the people doubting whether they should go to Assyria or Egypt, and besides this, all the false religion. And this is the situation in which Hosea ministry. Now let's move on to the next point in our introduction, the audience. And I'm not going to dwell long on this because this is rather simple. Hosea ministered to the northern kingdom. I'm not going to dwell long, as I said. Let's just take a point or two just to show this. Turn over to Hosea chapter 7, verse 5, and you'll notice where Hosea is ministering to the northern kingdom. Hosea chapter 7, verse 5. Hosea says, in the day of our king, the princes have made him sick with skins of wine. He stretched out his hand with scoffers and so on. He refers to the northern king as our king. We know it's the northern king because in verse 1, when I would have healed Israel, then the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered, and the wickedness of Samaria, and so on. And he's talking about the northern kingdom, and he says, our king. So he is speaking to the northern kingdom. He's not talking to those of the south. He's talking to the people in the northern kingdom. Furthermore, if you'd like, you might just put down this fact. He speaks of Ephraim 37 times. Another name for the northern kingdom is Ephraim, because the largest of the tribes in the northern kingdom was Ephraim. So the northern kingdom was called Ephraim. And so this is referred to 37 times. Furthermore, he many times refers to places in the northern kingdom, such as Samaria, Lebanon, which is north of the northern kingdom, Tabor, and so on. He refers to places in the north. So we can say that his audience is the northern kingdom. Fourthly, the style. One man has said, Jeremiah was the weeping prophet of the southern kingdom. Hosea is the sobbing prophet of the northern kingdom, and he's right. Hosea's writings they're just wet with tears. He's just weeping over the sin and the anarchy of his nation. I think that any Christian who is living in the United States of America today senses the feeling of Hosea. We get the same feeling, the corruption, the anarchy, the violence, the lawlessness, and you wonder, God, how long can our nation endure? And you begin to sob because you love our nation. And so Hosea sobs and weeps over the nation of Israel. Furthermore, it's abrupt. He's jerky in his writing. You'll be on one topic and you'll jump to another one and so on. It's abrupt because of the deep emotions. Whenever you're emotional, you jump around to the topics. And so this is what he does. So much for the man. Now let's look at the message. The message of Hosea is in two parts. First, chapters 1, 2, and 3, which I have called the prodigal wife. And then chapters 4 through 14, which I have called the prodigal nation. The prodigal wife is Hosea's personal experience. His wife goes out and becomes a prostitute. And this is like Israel, so that the experience of Hosea becomes the basis of his exhortation in the last part of the book. Remember the experience of the nation of Judah when Joel prophesied? The nation experienced a drought and a plague of locusts. This became the basis of his whole prophecy. Now Hosea has a terrible experience with his wife in her illicit relationship, and this experience in turn becomes the basis of his exhortation in the last 10 chapters or 11 chapters of the book. So we have the personal experience, the prodigal wife, or the prophetic exhortation, the last part, the prodigal nation. Now let's look at the book itself. We can move into the first three verses, and this is as far as we'll be able to get tonight. The first three verses of Hosea's book. Roman numeral 1, the personal experience. We've subtitled that the prodigal wife, 1:1 to 3:5. A, the symbolic family, 1:1 to 2:1. We're going to have three symbols: the symbolic family, the symbolic wife, the symbolic husband. We see in the first chapter the symbolic wife. The second chapter is the symbolic family. The first chapter, the second chapter, the symbolic wife. The third chapter, the symbolic husband. We begin with the two signs, and the first is the sign of Gomer. Hosea 1:1 to 1:3. Now let's begin with Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea the son of Beeri in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. The stress falls on the kings of Judah, because that's where the promised line was. That's where the kings that were the descendants of David ruled. So the kings of Judah are given first, they're given promise, because that's where God's promises rest. And in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, go, take unto thee a wife of harlotry, and the children of harlotry, For the land hath committed great harlotry, departing from the Lord.
Just a minute. Wait a minute. What does that mean when it says, go and take unto thee a wife of harlotry? Or as the King James Version says, a wife of whoredom and children of whoredom. Now, what does that mean? Do you think that God would tell a man to go out and marry a prostitute? Is that what he is saying here? Well, let me give you several alternative interpretations here. The first interpretation is this. It's just a myth. It's just an allegory. It's just a story. This didn't really happen. This is just what Hosea was thinking in his mind of an experience that he could possibly have. And so God puts these thoughts in his mind, and he really did marry a prostitute. It's just an allegory, a myth. Well, I don't think that that's what this is. This is too real for that. There's a second interpretation. Some say that the whoredom, the harlotry, is just a picture of idolatry. So what God is saying is, go marry a woman who worships idols. Now, just tonight at the table, as we're reading from the Word, reading from Joshua, I believe it's about chapter 22 or 23, and there it explicitly says that the children of Israel were not to marry idolatrous women. They were supposed to keep separate from false religion. So I don't think it's that. There's a third interpretation. Hosea married a woman who was perfectly clean and pure, but she became a harlot after they were married. Now that's a possibility. The fourth one is that God said, go out and marry a harlot. Now, frankly, I'm a literalist when I interpret the Scriptures. When I read the Bible, I think we ought to take it for what it says. As much as is possible, interpret the Scriptures literally. So that when God told Hosea, you go out and marry a harlot, I think that's exactly what he meant. Go out and marry a harlot, and furthermore, she already has children of her prostitution. Look at verse 2. Go take unto thee a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry. Now, what would that mean? That must mean that that woman had illicit relationships and she had children from these relationships, and the Lord told Hosea to go out and marry that woman. Now, there are several reasons why I take that to be so. One, that's what it says, and I might as well take it literally when that's what it says. Secondly, this is what Rahab, what happened to Rahab in the line of Jesus Christ. You may remember that when we looked at Matthew chapter 1, Rahab was a prostitute who lived on the walls of Jericho. And that prostitute, that woman of the street, in turn became a woman who was a foremother of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now that can only mean that some Israelite married that woman. Rahab was converted to God, to Jehovah God. That's obvious, she was converted because her faith spared her. The book of Hebrews says that her faith saved her. So that she believed in Jehovah God. And even though she had been that kind of a woman, some man in the nation of Israel married her. And in turn, that seemed to be in the line of Jesus Christ. There is no law in the Old Testament that says a man cannot marry a harlot, except for priests. Priests could not marry prostitutes. But there's no law that says a man could not do that. Hosea was not a priest, so he would not be breaking the law of God. There's a third reason why I believe this is what it means. The first is that this is what the literal meaning is. Secondly, there's no law against it in the Old Testament, and Rahab illustrated the fact that this was done. And thirdly, details in the story indicate that it is to be taken just as literally as possible. For instance, if you look down at verse 8, it's talking about the birth of Lo-Ruhamah and so on. Verse 8. Now, when she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and bore a son. Now, you notice that even the detail of weaning a child is given. If the detail of weaning a child is given, then I think we ought to take it just as literally as possible. If there are details like this, then we ought to accept the fact that he is told to go out and marry a prostitute. So this is what happened. Hosea, a holy prophet of God, a man who had been set apart by God to minister his word, was told to go out and marry a prostitute. and this woman had already conceived and bore children from these relationships. Now, the reason for that is to illustrate God's great love for Israel. If you take your Bible for a moment and turn back to the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24. Joshua chapter 24 and begin with verse 2. And Joshua said unto all the people, this is at the close of his ministry, Joshua said unto all the people, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, your fathers dwelt on the other side of the river of old, even Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river and led him throughout all the land of Canaan and multiplied his seed and gave him Isaac. Now, would you notice that the forefathers of Abraham were idolaters? They were heathen men. They did not worship Jehovah God. Abraham's father didn't even worship Jehovah God. It says that right here. He took Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. Now, what is this portraying? This is portraying the same thing that we have in Hosea's marriage. Hosea, by marrying a prostitute, is showing a love for somebody that doesn't deserve the love. And God, in his love for Abraham, took him out from that mess, from those false religions, and married him. Let's take another illustration of it. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Verses 7 and 8. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 7 and 8. The Lord did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people, for you were the fewest of all people. But because the Lord loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers, hath the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you out of the house of bondage from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. I loved you because I loved you. Not because of what you were, not because of what you had to offer, but I love you because I love you. And this is exactly what we have here. Hosea goes out and marries this woman just to show God's love for the nation Israel. Could we make it more pertinent than this? What have we got to offer? What is our intelligence or our power or our money? What have we got to offer God? We've got nothing to offer God. And yet God in his love, my friend, chose us. We think, what a strange thing for Hosea to choose a harlot. My friend, that's no different than God choosing us. We were wayward. We were sinful. We were rebellious. We had nothing within us, not a thing within us, to attract God's heart to us, except a soul. We're living beings, human beings. And that's the only thing. And God, in his love, took us to himself. And the church has become the bride of Jesus Christ, pure and spotless and not having wrinkle or any such thing. That's the power of God's grace. When I look at Hosea, I can't help but marvel at God's love for me. For as Hosea took a prostitute, so God took the church, and that church includes each one of us. It's a lovely, lovely thought. The next week, we'll look at Hosea's children. And these are really interesting children. That's the second sign. The first is the sign of the mother, the wife. The next is the sign of Hosea's children.